That's the music. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. And I'm really pleased because for the second time this year, I have Dr. Stella Resnick. She was last on this program February the 12th. We were talking about her new book. She has two wonderful books, but her newest book is The Heart of Desire. Welcome to this program, Dr. Stella.
Hi, Diana. A delight.
Well, Stella and I have known each other a long time, and I consider you a friend and certainly and really a mentor. I've shared this with you before, but I can remember hearing you, I pulled some notes out, 1992 at a Quad S conference talking about sexual potential. And so 92 and maybe even a little bit before that. But
perhaps we've actually even reached our sexual potential.
Oh, I would say so. Yes, good point.
20 years later.
Yes, yes, exactly. So we're going to look today, Dr. Stella Resnick and I are going to be looking at the evolution of sex therapy since Masters and Johnson, and this is a field that has expanded beyond the focus of sexual disturbance and dysfunction to an emphasis on sexual health, pleasure, and respect for diversity. And we're going to do this look back a little bit and forward, and it was inspired, and it was Stella's idea to do this show, and I'm so glad you came up with it, inspired by Virginia Johnson's death.
Recent death, yeah.
Recent death on July 24th at 88.
Mm-hmm.
And Time Magazine, August 12th, hasn't even happened yet, but they always put the date ahead, has an obit on her, and the way they opened it, I think, is worth repeating. There may never have been a topic people thought about more, but understood less than their own sexuality. That all changed in 1966, thanks to Virginia Johnson and her collaborator, Dr. William Masters, authors of the book Human Sexual Response, a dry but still groundbreaking work that moved beyond the earlier research of Alfred Kinsey, focusing less on sexual behavior and more on basic physiology. I think it's worth telling our listening audience how, in the early days, how Masters and Johnson worked and why they came up with such groundbreaking material on sexuality.
Well, Kinsey, of course, did the studies on sexuality in the human male and female. And those were primarily looking at frequency of sex. But there hadn't been any real science involved with sexuality that actually looked at what took place in the anatomy, in the physiology of people who were having sex. And Masters was an OBGYN in St. Louis, and of course he was in a great position to be able to do that kind of research, and that's what he started. He embarked on just putting people in a laboratory, starting with prostitutes and then moving on to regular couples. He thought he couldn't get regular people to sign on to such a research project, but he found that working with prostitutes had some challenges, particularly since they frequently had chronic pelvic infections.
Mm.
And that created a difficulty. So then he just reached out to the general public and got plenty of people, over 300 samples, in people in different, I think, men and women. And so he started to research using all kinds of physiological measures that were inserted in the vagina, and he had cameras in the vagina. I mean, he had all sorts of interesting apparatuses.
Yes.
And And so they were able to collect some data, and they came up with the human sexual response, the period that we're all familiar with, or many of us are, the rapid excitation, the plateau, the little blip that's orgasm, and then the resolution period. And this was the holy grail for a long time, although many of us suspected that that doesn't necessarily have to represent the human sexual response, that maybe that's just a kind of generalized, overgeneralized chart, and that what actually takes place for people doesn't necessarily conform to that particular chart, and people have different experiences. The other thing is that they said some interesting things that have been challenged. They said that all orgasms, whether it's felt as a clitoral or vaginal, is strictly clitoral. And of course, since that time, there have been studies on the G-spot, and which is, you know, in some cases still controversial whether all women have this or some women have this. But anyway, and the other thing is that they were primarily interested in what they considered to be sexual dysfunction. I mean, one of their books is called Sexual Inadequacy.
Right.
And sexual inadequacy, we would never use those terms today.
Yes. Still, they did a lot of sexual healing, Masters and Johnson, and their staff.
Oh, absolutely. They were certainly...
I have read, and there is this comes from the book Masters of Sex, The Life and Times of William Masters and Virginia Johnson, the couple who taught America how to love, that over 11 years they treated 186 men for premature ejaculation with a failure rate of only 2.2%. Pretty good. Mm-hmm. And all of the 29 women referred for vaginismus recovered sexual function, with 16 women experiencing orgasm for the first time in their lives during a two-week therapy.
Mm-hmm.
So if fear, worry, and shame cause sexual dysfunction, then they really, really worked hard to inventively to provide a remedy.
Mm-hmm. And they were the pioneers. I mean, or among the pioneers.
Yes.
They certainly did very important work. And a lot of, you know, the field of sex therapy itself really was begun by them, because they had a particular way of working. You know, they worked together, and they talked about being a male and a female therapist.
Yes.
With
uh-huh.
What was essentially a male and female couple. So I think they did do some work with homosexuals.
Yes.
And I think they actually did some randomization of putting couples together, homosexual as well as heterosexual couples, and they studied them.
Mm-hmm.
I believe they also tried to do a conversion kind of therapy with people who identified as gay, or during that time, I guess the term gay wasn't really used. And then they... had to renounce that they weren't really as effective as they thought they were or tried to be. So, but they were very important in the field of sex therapy, and they got the ball rolling, essentially. Before Masters and Johnson, the people who worked with sexual issues were basically not working with sexual issues. They were working with sexual problems, in the sense, you know, psychoanalysis. Freud saw people who had sexual issues, and there was, of course, a great deal of sexual frustration during the Victorian era when Freud was alive and practicing and theorizing. So, before Masters and Johnson, there wasn't really a field of sex therapy, and they created some very important methods, like sensate focus, for example.
Yeah, now before you go on to that, I just a little sidebar here that I thought was very interesting. One of the first MDs who came aboard in the Masters and Johnson was Dr. Kolodny and Bob.
Mm-hmm.
And he came out of Harvard, and he said, a mentor of mine in medical school told me, you're throwing your medical career away.
Oh, that's...
In 1969, sex therapy was regarded as some frivolous, almost voyeuristic area that no serious person would ever engage in.
Mm-hmm.
Colleagues conjured up fantasies about the sex clinic only to be disappointed by the humdrum reality. Sex therapy was not watching people getting undressed and having sex together. I was taking care of people with sexual illnesses, consulting with people. Sexual illnesses, now, we're going to talk about how sex therapy has evolved in your specialty, which is sexual pleasure. But I interrupted you because you wanted to talk about sensate focus, and I think that's very appropriate.
I don't need to talk about sensate. I'm just saying that that's certainly one of the contributions of their work, that they started the exploration of sexuality with non-genital touching and getting into the pleasure of the experience, and they even wrote a book called The Pleasure Bond, which they talked about no matter what happens with regard to how well, so-called, you know, that you have intercourse, that the part of the major reason to have sex is just the pleasure of the contact, and that there are many different ways in which you have that contact, and that that the pleasure that you give to one another strengthens the bond of your relationship. But of course, they were speaking about heterosexual sex between committed couples, basically. That was where they started. And sex therapy has evolved from that. It's evolved, but it's gone through a period of where we've really been very focused on sexual pathology. You know, I believe that a big part of the reason why we, in the 80s, got into a focus on sex as problematic and dysfunctional, and of course HIV and sexually transmitted diseases were prominent in people's minds, and the big emphasis on child abuse was around then. There were several trials that were going on with teachers being suspected of sex abuse of their children, and of course that still goes on to today.
Mm-hmm.
Although the children are getting a little older, they're now, you know, in their teens.
Yes.
But in any event, and many of those cases were thrown out anyway because they were found to be the interviewers were kind of directing the children's responses without really even knowing it. But so we've gone through a period of where we sex therapy itself was focused on the behavior, first of all, on the behavior of sex and of having a major outcome that had to do with being able to have vaginal intercourse. That was the goal of Masters and Johnson. But the field has evolved, and with it, whether the field has led the culture or the social culture has inspired the field. You know, it's a back and forth kind of thing. And attitudes have shifted, and our knowledge has shifted. We've become a lot more open, verbally talking about sex. Of course, it helps to have some sex scandals in politics to open things up, you know. When Clinton was president, of course, we got to have a great conversation about oral sex.
We did. He inspired lots of conversations about that. And then you also note that Dr. David Satcher in 2001 was a major influence. Can you talk a little bit about that, Stella?
Yes. Well, to me, David Satcher made a very big impact on the field because after going through a period where much of the focus in, you know, our professional organizations, sex therapists, researchers, educators, where we were primarily focused on abuse, on addiction, on unwanted teenage pregnancy, you know, all the difficulties that people come in with.
Yes.
That David Satcher, who was Bill Clinton's Surgeon General.
Yes.
And he had written a number of calls to action as a Surgeon General. He came out with a book on or a call to action that I believe it was called Call to Action for, let me see if I can remember what the full title of Call to Action on Responsible Sexual Behavior.
And to promote sexual health.
And to promote, on right, it was a call to action on sexual health and responsible sexual behavior.
Yes.
And the whole notion of sexual health, that was a major contribution to the conversation, to look at what it was that that the fact that there were so many instances of children being having unwanted sexual experiences and not being able to talk about it, of where so many people were taken advantage of, and there was no support in a sense in the community, and so the book was called The Surgeon General's Call to Action to Promote Sexual Health and Responsible Sexual Behavior, And basically what he said was that sexual health was not limited to the absence of disease or dysfunction.
Exactly.
And that it wasn't just about what happens during your reproductive years. He said that it was very much a part of physical and mental health, that sexual health was a part of overall general health. And that it was important to recognize that people really needed to be able to integrate their sexuality, their feelings about sex, into their daily lives and to derive pleasure from it. And even just saying to derive pleasure from it, that was such an important statement to make. And what he essentially did with that thin little booklet, which didn't have much of an impact on the general public, but it really brought a whole new positive focus on sex into the field. But first of all, by highlighting the interconnection, the interconnectedness of sexual health, physical health, and emotional well-being.
Yes.
But then he also talked about how sexual health started in childhood. And, you know, Freud in 1826 or around there tried to, 1856, tried to talk about childhood sexuality, infantile sexuality, and he was laughed at, and he has continued to be laughed at even by psychoanalysts today who think that that was a big mistake. You know, we now know that babies are born sexual, that little male babies have erections in the womb, that little girl babies start to lubricate by age 3, that children are very sexual.
Well, and looking at the children in the womb masturbating.
Yeah, well, whether they're masturbating, I don't know. But they're certainly, they stick their finger in their mouth, they stick their finger on their genitals. You know, I don't know if they're masturbating. That's a funny concept. But, or, you know, even to think of it as masturbation when they take delight in touching their genitals, when they're laying naked, you know, when they're being diapered and they play with their genitals, you know, is that masturbation or is that exploration?
It feels good. It feels good.
Certainly children are fascinated by their genitalia, and they discover very early on that there's a very special feeling there.
So
David Satcher acknowledged that sexuality spans the lifetime from childhood to old age. Now, that was very important that he acknowledged that, because up until that time it was considered that sexuality really was something that was most highly developed during the years of reproduction and then not before, and that it began to decline, and before you knew it, it was over. And what we now know is that sexuality continues well into the 90s and perhaps beyond. You know, I don't think we have that many studies that have asked octogenarians or centenarians about their sex habits. But in any event, so we have broadened our understanding of the range of sexuality. And, you know, we continue to make discoveries. For example, we now know that the clitoris, which used to be considered to be the size of a pea, that was many thought was placed in the wrong spot because it wasn't being stimulated during intercourse. So obviously, nature made a mistake by putting the clitoris where it put it. But now we know that the clitoris, what you see is the little pea, is really just the glands of a structure that is analogous to the penis. And so the clitoris has the glands and has that, which has a hood, just like a penis, and a shaft, and that it has two extensions on either side of the shaft that are the crura, the legs, and that the clitoris itself is a large organ that if it were to be stretched out, it would be about 8 inches long, which is pretty good for a girl. So
pretty good, and some people theorize that the G-spot may be the root of the clitoris.
That's nice.
Yeah. and we know that the clitoris has approximately 8,000 nerve fibers, and the penis has 4,000. So, and the only purpose of the clitoris is for pleasure. Whereas,
right,
of course, we all know that penis has lots of functions.
You know, we're not competing with men.
We're not. I'm just pointing out that, it's important for men to know about the clitoris and all of the possibilities.
Right.
Yeah.
And for women to, and for everybody to know about the penis and all of those possibilities
as well. Of course.
Because, you know, there's often a very narrow sense of this poor penis that, you know, once it gets aroused, it has to have an ejaculation right away, or all sorts of problem pain, and that men have to have orgasms, and I mean, there are all kinds of ways in which we all could learn more about the sexual anatomy and all our ways of being turned on and enjoying ourselves. And then, you know, if we continue to look at how sex therapy has evolved, first of all, some of the things that have been considered pathological or abnormal have been taken off the abnormal list, like homosexuality, which was taken off the list of the DSM in 1973, and what used to be called perversions, people's predilections for different kinds of ways of expressing their sexuality. We're now referring to different predilections as paraphilia, so exhibitionism or BDSM, bondage discipline, sadomasochistic playfulness, where people have contracts with each other and safe words and to play. And of course, there was recent literature, well, you wouldn't call it literature, the 50 Shades of Gray.
Well, no, it's not literature, but it certainly other conversations were started. And I just want to interject that in the International Society of Sexual Medicine Journal, just 2 months ago, there was the psychological characteristics of BDSM practitioners, and they concluded that BDSM may be thought as a recreational leisure rather than an expression of psychopathology processes.
Right. Who said this?
So these are some, guess where they come out of, these researchers, the Netherlands. The Dutch are open. And but it was a very thorough, I'll send you the study. It's very interesting.
Oh, that's great. Well, yes, I mean, this is something that has been viewed in this way in the sexological, sex therapy, sex education communities, that BDSM, when it is between consenting adults and when the play is safe, in the sense that the person who is in a, shall we say, a submissive position has the control over what transpires in this encounter, that unlike how it appears, where the one who is administering the whip or whatever, the chains or the humiliation, is in control, it's actually the bottom who is in control, because he or she can cut it off at any time.
And Stella, we're going to have to go to a break, but the sort of the bottom line is that good communication in these rituals is absolutely required and for these couples. So we're going to talk more, so I know you'll want to stay with us. Dr. Stella Resnick is a wealth of information. I'm just so happy you're on the show today.
It's a delight to be here.
Thank you. We'll be right back, so stay with us. We're back. This is Dr. Diana Wiley. I'm here with Dr. Stella Resnick, and I wanted to talk a little bit about how sex therapists really are also sex educators. Building on the work of Masters and Johnson, mental health professionals like myself and Dr. Stella Resnick, I think we've learned, and you can agree with me or not, we've learned that much of people's dissatisfactions about sex come from misinformation, negative attitudes, anxiety, poor communication, and unrealistic expectations. So part of our job is to be sex educators. We're in session.
Absolutely. I think that's a very important point. misinformation, negative attitudes, social attitudes about sex, and many of those come from their parents and teachers as they were growing up.
Yeah.
And, there has certainly been a lot of misinformation with regard to sex. And if you think about the fact that because most children can't talk to their parents about, or
mm-hmm.
it's better now. I mean,
it's better.
You see that most children couldn't talk to their parents about sex, and that's one of the reasons why, you know, children often didn't share with parents their fears or if they had been had unwanted sex with anybody because they didn't think they would be understood, and many times they thought they would be punished, and sometimes they were. So, anxiety and shame has been certainly part of many people's experience about their early sex life, coming out of a lack of education, a lack of information. Many kids learned about sex primarily as 9-year-olds from other 9-year-olds,
mm-hmm.
which is not a great source.
Not a great source, no.
And so, you talk about unrealistic expectations, and much of that is driven by the media. People going to the movies, and what do you see in the movies? You see these people who look into each other's eyes, and they start to breathe like bulls, and and begin to rip their clothing off, and clear the kitchen tables with a sweep of their elbow, and go to it,
and they're going at it.
2 minutes, it's over, and it's so exciting. I mean, that's where a lot of people are getting their information about sex, and that is not what sex is about. That's really bad sex. That's not good sex. I call that frenzied sex.
Frenzied sex.
You know, where they can't stand their turn on. Of course, we are getting some movies that have a lot better depictions of nice slow build of heat and excitement, and people actually looking into each other's eyes, and no clothing is being ripped, and sometimes people make love with different items of their clothing still on, and how hot is that? So, so it is important to give people better information about sex, and also to take things somewhat less seriously, to look at people's predilections, not necessarily in negative terms. That's certainly one of the things that has been a hallmark of sexology and research and sex therapy in the last 20 years or more, 25 years, has been the recognition of sexual diversity. And
yes,
there are many ways to express your sexual desire and to enjoy sexual pleasure that don't necessarily involve heterosexual missionary-style intercourse. Which is often over in 20 minutes. What Sherry Height, the researcher, called formula sex.
Formula sex.
Formula sex,
mm-hmm.
Which was essentially foreplay, penetration, male ejaculation, occasional female orgasm. I mean, that was what she described as formula sex, and she challenged Masters and Johnson, who said that women have orgasms through thrusting, and she said, well, not necessarily, that she did a lot of research and found that many women described how they came to orgasm during intercourse, and she observed that only 30% of women actually were able to achieve orgasm through intercourse, that 70% of women did not. And she said the 30% of women who did achieve orgasm through intercourse often did so through deep penetration and grinding movements, not necessarily thrusting. So that was also some interesting data, I thought. And in any event, you know, what we're seeing is that this is a much more diverse field where we can really regard a wide variety of sexual behaviors as within the normal, so-called normal realm. If you think of normality as something that resembles a bell curve statistically, then there's no reason to assume that that all of this variety is not part of normality. So we can see that heterosexuality and homosexuality, lesbian, gay, bisexual, even transgender,
yes,
be seen as part of the spectrum of normal, healthy, can be healthy sexual desire and behavior, activity. So, even today, I mean, there are people who are exploring, bisexuality. You talked about Time magazine. Well, bisexuality made Time or Newsweek, one of those magazines, made the cover one year when they were finding that college kids were exploring their sexuality by having sex the same sex. Women were having sex with women, men were having sex with men. They weren't necessarily identified as gay or lesbian. They were just exploring their sexuality. I found websites in which this was kind of encouraged on that were aiming for college kids and saying, explore your sexuality. Try having sex other people
same gender,
other women or with other men or in threesomes, and see what that's like. And if you don't like it, don't do it. And if you like it, it's not considered abnormal. So I thought, well, boy, this is interesting stuff.
It certainly didn't occur when we were in college, did it? not that I was heard about
when
it
I was
anyway.
In college, but certainly when I was in graduate school.
Okay, good. Well, it seems as though female sexuality is a little more fluid, based on some studies, than male sexuality.
I do like that whole notion of sexual fluidity.
Yes, I do too.
People saying, "Well, I'm heterosexual. I'm primarily heterosexual, but I'm also fluid,"
right.
And so that's a lovely concept. And so what does this mean? So what is the role now of sex therapy? I mean, what are we doing now in sex therapy?
Very good, Estella. Let's talk about that. What are we doing in sex therapy? I have to interject just this. I became aware of this quite a long time ago that, I say that when God was passing out talents, I got ease in talking about sex. I've always had that ease, and that contributes very well to my being a sex therapist,
mm-hmm.
and also to being very positive about sexuality, and I know you the same. I mean, our clients can feel this when we're kind of like sexual cheerleaders, in that it's a good thing to be positive about sexuality and the pleasure bond and your book, The Pleasure Zone.
Mm-hmm.
But the sex therapist, I think it's essential that the sex therapist displays a non-judgmental attitude. It's not helpful if someone comes in with some sort of kink and the therapist might say, "You do what?"
Right. Well, that's
good.
One of the reasons to go to a sex therapist and not
right.
just choose any therapist. Not to say that there aren't psychologists and psychiatrists who actually see clients, patients, I guess they call them. But,
yes.
You know, that you may get lucky, but you're going to get a lot luckier if you want to talk about sex to go to a certified sex therapist or counselor or sex coach, you know. And there are a variety of different disciplines of people who are working in the field, sex educators as well, who are not going to have a judgmental attitude, who'll be able to listen to you and look at it from the terms of what whether or not this is contributing to your health, your growth as a person, what your feelings are about it. Now, generally speaking, when individuals come to for therapy, they're having a concern about their sex life.
Of course.
Something that is challenging them. And I like to think of it in that way. I like to think of it as a challenge because I do believe that all our problems, emotional problems, sexual problems, personal problems, are really challenges to evolve ourselves. That what a problem shows is a place where we're stuck. And that with some focused attention in a non-judgmental way and a discovery of the how we've been programmed, of the emotions, of what our experience has been, and naturally we would find ourselves where we find ourselves now. And the question becomes, well, how can we learn from this? How can we develop ourselves in a way that through our sexuality, through sexual pleasure as being the incentive, how are we going to grow as a human being? How are we going to grow? And in the process, perhaps drop some of our fears, our shames, our negative attitudes about ourselves, and how will this help us to result in a better emotional well-being as well as greater sexual pleasure with ourselves or with a partner?
And isn't that a huge satisfaction in our work when we do have clients who have a lot of personal growth because their pleasure, their sexual lives increase? And I believe our sexuality is at our core, and when we can reduce the or eliminate the shame and the guilt and all of those things and embrace our sexuality and then have better sex.
Well,
I mean, we can see it. We can see it with, and they come back the next week, and if they've done their homework, and I would like to talk a little bit about sex homework.
Mm-hmm.
If they've done their homework, they've often made progress.
Well, even if they don't do their homework, they make progress. Because one of the things we look at when they don't do their homework is what stopped them.
Exactly.
And that's as telling sometimes as what happens when they do their homework.
Yeah.
You know, and you said something I thought that really very important to highlight, which is something that I believe very strongly, and that is that our sexuality is at the core of our personality development.
Yeah.
And why this is the case is because we are born sexual, and at the time when we are forming our associations, our bonding with our parents and our attachment to other humans and feelings of love and feelings of safety and how we deal with stress and how we deal in relationships, all of that is occurring from infancy through childhood, through teen years, into our adult years. All of that is occurring in the context of a sexual being, born sexual. So it's from childhood on that our attachment, conditioning, our bonding, our love experiences are all being influenced during the time that we are sexual. And it's conflated. There's an element there that is part of the conditioning of how we bond with another human being. And, of course, this is what my second book is about, The Heart of Desire, because so many couples lose sexual interest once they make a commitment to one another.
Yeah.
And I showed how it's not just as a result of being together for 20 years and getting into a sexual rut, that sometimes the people who lose interest for one another do so within days of committing to being to each other, and or certainly once they move in together, because they start treating each other less like lovers and more like family. So they get into all these kind of parent-child roles or brother-sister roles, and the body is conditioned to turn our sexual feelings off in the presence of family. We learn that very early on, that it is not appropriate to feel sexual in the presence of family. And we learn it through the frowns and disgust or punishment of parents told to diminish our sexual desire and, you know, turn ourselves off and be careful and all that stuff. So we fall in love with a stranger, and it's safe to have sexual desire and excitement with a stranger. But then when we commit to that stranger then becomes family. And
the incest taboo is, even though all of this probably occurs unconsciously, but the incest taboo is huge.
Yes, and
I want to remind people about
your
book.
It's an important taboo because we don't want there to be much sexual play between family members. There's certainly a lot more sex play among siblings than is often acknowledged. I mean, that a lot of people I have worked with who've had a lot of shame about having engaged in sex play with brothers or sisters. And, one of the things that we do as sex therapists is normalize some of this stuff.
Normalize it.
So that happens all the time.
Yep.
They ever talk to their siblings about it. Well, talk to them about it, see what they say, see how they feel about it, to the importance of opening this up. But, of course, you don't want there to be any sex play between parents and children. And that's important. And, of course, most parents don't. But some parents have a real fear about it and create real fear in their children. When the girl throws her arms around her daddy and he pushes her away, what does that do to her? When the mother sees her little boy, and how beautiful he looks, she turns away from him. So, there are dangers of that too. But so one of the things, of course, we do as sex therapists is we normalize some of these sexual experiences, and we do give people information. As a therapist, too, I'm making use of some of the data that are coming from other fields as well, not just from the field of sex therapy and research, but from the field of brain scanning and attachment research and looking at this very fact that as we are learning how to bond in a loving relationship, we're also feeling sex feelings and learning to suppress those feelings. And so that's one of the things I work on with some of my clients. I see a lot of couples in which libido is an issue. Often one person has a greater desire for sex than the other. sometimes both of them have lost desire for sex with each other and they really want it back. One of the things I do look at with them is their early attachment history and how that is affecting their current relationship, their current intimate relationship, and how they can now create a distinction between their partner and family. And, of course, my approach to this is to help them to develop their erotic skills, romance. Romance and eroticism is the key to differentiate your partner as a lover and not as family. And,
yes.
And that's my work now with a lot of the couples that I see, is to remember that what we think of as flirting is really, in the animal world, mating rituals. And without those mating rituals, without those plays, the way in which giraffes wrap their necks around each other, or the way lions may play a little violent, you know, slapping each other, and bugs do sit-ups for each other. I mean, that's, you know, really goes all the way down to the first form, you know. And, you know, that humans need to do that, too. It's not enough to say, hey, you know, you want to fool around? Get into bed, and, you know, I'll get on top of you, and we'll do this, and then we'll do this, and it's all over. That's not the highlight of sex that you can have. You can really enhance your sexuality by remembering the importance of courtship, you know, mating rituals, mating. And in human terms, mating rituals are being romantic and being playful and being sexy and being fun and play. It's all about play. And then getting
into
the eroticism of it, you know, and developing your sexual fantasy and developing your erotic personality and all of that stuff.
Well, we are coming to the end of the program because PRN likes me to stop a couple minutes before the top of the next hour. I want to remind our listeners that your book, your most recent book, is available on Amazon.com. Is that right?
And they can also come to my website.
Yeah, and that's Dr. Dr. Stella Resnick, R-E-S-N-I-C-K, .com.
Mm-hmm.
And so the book, The Heart of Desire, is a wonderful book. Covering how pleasure informs love and romance, sexual pleasure, a 10-step loving sex program. It's an amazing, amazing book. And your first book, too, it's internationally. It's been a bestseller, The Pleasure Zone. So we have been fortunate in this last hour to have Dr. Stella Resnick.
Oh, I've enjoyed every minute of it. I always do enjoy you, Diana. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Stella. I always enjoy you, and I think you're leaving this world a sexually smarter place.
Thanks, but I'm not going anywhere.
I know, but I mean, just, you know, I know, you're vital. I just saw you in Los Angeles with Brian and you and your husband, and didn't we have fun? Yeah, no, you're not going anywhere. I didn't
I'm leaving the world yet.
Yeah, no, but you are, you know, you're just such a, you contribute so much in the way of sexual knowledge, and so thank you, Stella Resnick.
Thank you, Dr. Diana.
And we'll be in touch.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye, everybody. Next week, Bradley Coates.
telefone.